haven't been with us for quite some time.
The lost son.
No, but look, he's got many important matters of his party to attend to. But because he saw that we made the headlines again today, he said, let me rather come to this committee, at least I can boost my profile or something. You know? In a run-up to the presidential race, I need to boost my profile. So he's made a comeback to the committee. Well, in the business day, he's got a bit of a story about the committee and Centec and all that, and in Cape Times. So Reverend Zondi said, look, here's my chance to come back. No, I'm just teasing you, Reverend Zondi. You know I always tease you on this matter. Only as a chair I have the liberty to tease the Reverend. Ordinarily you can't tease the Reverend. There's a few housekeeping matters. Next week's program, if you remember, we've got a meeting on Tuesday afternoon. That's for the informal deliberations on the post office bill. Wednesday, we've got the SABC for the better part of the day. And then for our budget review and something report, PRRR report, we've got it scheduled for Thursday. But we've also got this conference that the House Chairperson has invited us, and they wanted five members of this committee to go to a conference which is taking place in Johannesburg. So the first proposal I want to put forward is that we try and finish the PRRR report on Wednesday afternoon, so that at least those who want to go to the conference can go on Thursday and Friday. It's got to do with e-parliament or something like that. It looks like an interesting program. And I think the committee is allowed five members. Is that it? So it's a chairperson plus five. So the six members. So we need names from the opposition parties. At least I would think two names from the opposition parties and three names from the ANC as to who will be attending. Thursday and Friday at Pan-African Parliament is in Gallagher Estate. Is that where? Yeah, so that's where it is. It starts in the morning at 9 o'clock on Thursday. I think there was a note sent out of the invitation yesterday. Okay, so we will send out the formal program, etc. No, that's where it's taking place. But it's a conference on e-parliament or something like that. I don't understand. I haven't got the exact details. Then there's also another conference on the Tuesday and Wednesday. But we are not clear about, we've been trying to get, because it talks about a speaker's forum and an executive council, and we were trying to work out why we as members of parliament should be there, because it seemed to have been official structures. And I want to propose that we decline that invitation and not attend that one on Tuesday and Wednesday, precisely because we've got quite a bit of work, and I think we need a full quorum for the SABC. So that's the proposal I want to put to the committee. So in short, we don't take on Tuesday, Wednesday. We go Thursday, Friday, whatever the delegation is. And we finish our PRRR report on Wednesday afternoon. If members are comfortable with that. I have conferred with the whip of the committee. I don't know where he is. We were together a little while ago. So he's on his way. But in principle, the whip has agreed. I'd like to hear the other views of the other members. Are we okay? Sorry. I said, are you comfortable with this proposal? Fine, so then we will cancel then Thursday's meeting next week and try and finish it on Wednesday. Okay. The second thing in terms of housekeeping, while we're waiting for, how many are we now? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We need one more member for a quorum. Shall we wait? Okay. It's a bad day today, I think. Yeah? I've got an invitation. I think the letter has been circulated. I'd like members just to read this. It comes from the Department of Communication. It's addressed to the speaker. There's a department, SABC, and National Treasury delegation that there's a task team at the moment that was constituted some time ago to look at the finances and the turnaround strategy of the SABC between National Treasury and the Department. Now, that task team wants to undertake a tour to the UK and to Canada to go and look at the business and funding model of the of those two institutions with a view towards getting some lessons for the SCPC. And at this stage, they've got foreign funding. It's from the Canadian International Development Agency. And the funding the funding covers six people. So from Treasury, et cetera, they have, they've already got a delegation of five, but they're inviting the chairperson of the committee, of this committee, to be part of the delegation. But it only covers the travel, the airfares and accommodation is what seems to be covered from what I understand. So this letter comes from Dr. Risso. I thought that it's important to get the committee's views on the matter and not to say that we should accept or we shouldn't accept. That's one. If we do accept, I am of the view that it will not be sensible to go to the British, the BBC, because I think we've been there as a committee, and I'm led to believe that the deputy CEO of the BBC was fired yesterday, I think. So I don't know what we're going to learn from them, but the Canadian thing is something we should be looking at a bit more carefully. I've looked at the program. It will mean that if this is agreed, then the SAPO, for the SAPO presentation and the MISA, I might not be here. And the week after is ICASA. And I certainly would not want to miss the ICASA presentation, because I think it's important. So if the committee does agree in supporting this, then it will only be for the Canadian League. That's the proposal that I would like to put forward. But I'd like to hear your views on the matter. If the committee agrees that we should accept this invitation, then it should be, I'm suggesting that it should only be for the Canadian leg of it and not both the countries. At the moment, the invitation is to the chairperson, yeah. Mastery? It's both the work and also the fact that we have met with the BBC when we went down. I mean, we've had quite a bit of discussions with them. So, you know, I don't want to, I mean, spend another 4 days just to sit with the BBC. If I had it my way, I would have taken all of you, but we are dependent on these people's funding.
Chairperson, I want to echo the sentiments of my other colleagues with regards to the invitation that the chairperson should go. I understand the difficulties that the chairperson is putting forward, which are making it difficult for him to undertake the British leg of the trip. But in view of the fact that the BBC is always flighted as having a unique funding model, which is basically different from ours, it would have been, even if, for example, the chairperson can only do the Canadian leg, I don't know if it would be possible to find another member of the committee then to join the British one, especially those who were there before. They can link it with what was started before, so that we capture both the experiences, so that it doesn't only remain with the department. This kind of experience, the committee does need to have it. That would be my take.
Okay. So can I take it that the committee then supports this and with a view towards doing both legs of the trip, and let us see what are the possibilities there then. Thank you very much. I know you left behind a girlfriend there. I mean, there were many nights when you disappeared. Can the media please report this? Parliamentary PMG, please. Put this in the on the record there. but I was talking about her. All right. I think we should proceed, members. Mr. Mukela, Wolf, am I getting it right now? Mr. Munshizelele. Welcome to you and the rest of the team. I've had a request from members that we should try and round up by about 4:30, if it's possible. So we are a bit hard-pressed for time, although the program is at 5 o'clock. Members, if you remember, we had gone through halfway through this bill informally, in terms of our informal discussion. And on a lot of the corporate governance issues, we had asked the legal people to take what we did with the post-bank bill and to transpose, is that the right word? Transpose it onto here so that we have tightened up the corporate governance mechanisms and controls that we desire. I think the department has done that. And there might have been one or two further amendments. So what we have before us is a bill which is now almost in an amended form, not the original bill. And we're going to ask them to take us through those amendments, to talk to them, on the understanding that we're not finalizing this matter today. We're still having another bite at this next week, Tuesday, at an informal level. So we don't have to exhaust all the issues today. We can carry it over to next week, Tuesday, if we have to. So can I hand over then to the team?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. I think the Honorable Chair has summarized what we need to do today and what we have done as a department. We have, following the meeting of 14 September 2010, went back to work on the bill together with the chief state law advisors. So what we'll be presenting today is a product of that process. With me here is the team, Mr. Alf Wood, the director, Willie Vukela, director also in the postal, Dimakazo Mujela, also deputy director in the postal unit, and Pindle Dlamini, a deputy director in the postal unit. Without wasting too much time, Chairperson, I'll hand over to Mr. Wiltz to take you through the amendment. Mr. Wiltz.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and members. Slide 3, we start with the amendment of the long title. We've removed the reference to the separation of accounts between reserved and unreserved services we'll get to it later, but we will propose the deletion of clause 4. Because of that proposed deletion, the long title should also be changed. You'll see in the second bullet, the part between brackets is then the part to be removed. Slide 4, the arrangement of sections, we've just aligned it with the proposed changes in the bill. The definitions clause, the committee was correct in pointing out that is the definition for Director General really necessary, and we found no reference to the word DG in the text, so that the definition can be removed. We've then also changed the definition of family member to be aligned with the well-debated definition in the post-bank bill. So you'll see it now includes underlined part or a stepchild, and then the reference to a life partner. Clause 2.
Members, in terms of the procedure, can we suggest that if we finish a section, you've got a question or something, you just take it then. Otherwise, we've got a lengthy presentation and we're able to come back. So if you've got any questions, just flag.
Thank you, Chair. On slide 6 is clause 2, the objects of the Act. We've just amended the heading from purpose to objects of Act, as proposed by the Honourable Committee. Clause 3, the continued existence of the Post Office. We've just added one subparagraph 2F that reads, the repeal referred to in subsection 1 does not affect the continued existence of any subsidiary of the Post Office. Clause 4, the separation of accounts. We
one thing there on my side. If you remember in our discussion, we did say that the Post Office must give us some presentation of its company structure, the group and the subsidiary. And I think it was Advocate De Lange who said that, how does this law, if it becomes a law, apply to the subsidiaries? And I don't know if that matter was addressed in any way.
Chair, if Chair will permit me, I'll get to it a bit later when we deal with Clause 6.2b. That's the clause that reads, this Act applies with the necessary changes to subsidiaries of the Post Office. So in that clause, we've made amendments, and it's actually as a result of those amendments that we picked this part up. And the State Law Advisor said, let's insert this one right up front rather than in 6.2b. To deal with the continued existence of those subsidiaries. If I may continue, Chair, then Clause 4, I said the separation of accounts issue. As promised last time, we undertook, in view of the fact that the Post Office is of the view that Clause 4 is a regulatory matter that doesn't belong in this bill, we firstly explained that it was upon ICASA's request that we actually inserted this clause in the bill. However, that we'd go back to ICASA and establish whether other regulations have overtaken this request and whether it's still necessary to have Clause 4. They then said it's not necessary, it's taken care of in principle through regulation, and therefore we can remove Clause 4. Clause 5 is the clause dealing with the duties of the Post Office, which I think we also previously had thorough deliberation on. We've tried to remove some of the duplication and ambiguity in the section, and especially to see to what extent are those obligations really achievable. Can we tone it down in line with some of the wording in the Constitution we were mandated to do? The obligation imposed on the Post Office to perform the duties in this clause was further made subject to reasonability, the availability of resources, and the progressive realization of duty. So those are that's the wording we borrowed from the Constitution. And then we've added, we made those duties subject to the provisions of the Postal Services Act and the license issued to the Post Office. That's because if in here you have a general statement on universal service obligation or on universal service or on universal access, then it's qualified through the license that ICASA issues to the Post Office. Therefore, even if there's a broad obligation here that says you must achieve universal service, it's still subject to ICASA's regulation in that matter through the license. The license would give specific universal service targets or universal access requirements. Therefore, the new Clause 5 reads, subject to the Postal Services Act and the license issued to the Post Office in terms of the said Act, the Post Office must take reasonable measures within its available resources to achieve the progressive realization of the following duties. A. Ensure the universal and affordable provision of postal services. B. Ensure the provision of a wide range of affordable postal services in the interest of the economic growth and development of the Republic. C. Be innovative in the provision of postal services. D. Develop postal services that are responsive to the needs of users and consumers. Then we proposed the removal of Clause E and Clause F. G then reads, ensure that the needs of disabled persons are taken into account in the provision of postal services. H, ensure the development of human resources and capacity building within the postal industry, especially among historically disadvantaged groups. Act in the best interest of postal users and other clients. J, maintain an effective and efficient system of collecting, sorting, and delivering mail nationwide in a manner responsive to the needs of all categories of mail users. Then some amendment to Clause K, actively provide and develop a citizen's post office that contributes to community and rural development and education, thereby serving as an interface between government and the community. Right there, we've removed the reference to and provide a center for community activities, because that may be quite onerous. L, ensure compliance with international commitments relevant to the postal industry. And then we've also suggested that paragraph M be taken out. Chair, I have to pause here, though, because even though in here and in the bill in front of the Honourable Committee, we've proposed the deletion of Clause 5.1e. We've realized subsequently that 5.1e should not be deleted, but just amended. The existing Clause 5.1a describes universal service, while Clause 5.1e is necessary to describe universal access. So we'll propose that Clause 5.1e read, ensure the achievement of universal access to postal services by providing an acceptable level of effective, reliable, and regular postal services to all areas, including rural areas and small towns where post offices are not sustainable. Chair, there's just a reason for this. What happened is, Chair will remember that we were requested to go back and look at a possible definition for universal service and access. And we proposed a definition, but realized it's very difficult to, in such a short space of time, without appropriate consultation, just insert definitions for those. And the State Law Advisor eventually proposed that we take out the definitions which we've proposed, which means we have to go back to the text and at least in the text provide wording that, in a sense, describes the post office's duties in respect of universal service and access. Then continuing.
Let me just ask a question. I can see the need why we should drop M, because it's in a sense partly covered in E. But why are we dropping F? Because I mean, the quality of services in urban and rural areas, physical infrastructure is radically different, and we should move towards greater equity in the quality of the services. And that's an important idea. So why are you proposing that we delete that? Because it's not covered anywhere else.
Chair, my understanding of ensuring greater equity in respect of the distribution of services is very similar to the definition of universal service. So in my view, it equates to universal service, where you have the universal accessibility of postal services, there's universal access and there's universal service. And this amounts to the availability of postal services everywhere, ensure greater equity in respect of the distribution of services.
Access and universal service is one thing. Equity has got a different meaning. It recognizes that there's inequalities, built-in inequalities within the system. And it's important to get an equal level of service across all communities. That's quite different from universal access, which means everybody should have access or that it should be affordable, etc. That's a different concept. Equity in the current context, because I mean you have, you go to the Cape Town City Post Office here, first world, top class, high tech. Okay. Go to the one in Johannesburg, even better than Cape Town. Go to the post office in Joburg, even better than Cape Town. But then go to a rural post office. It's a dingy little place, a small office. Those services, they might be accessible and universal in a sense, but they're not equal. And that's an issue that I think we can't just let go of.
I just want to say, believe it or not, but I agree totally with you, and sorry, Mr. Wiltz, I think the chairperson is correct. Sorry. Well, try.
Very good. Mrs. Zasha?
Greater equity and put the ensure equality in respect to the distribution of services.
Legal people. Equity has got a particular meaning.
Yeah, that's true. That's
got a particular meaning it has. No, I think I'm making a case that we must retain it.
It's fine with us, Chair. Of course, we've initially proposed that it be there. In fact, it also mirrors the objects in the Postal Services Act. So it's already covered in law, at least there's a broader objective to be achieved through another postal law. Certainly nothing wrong with it. We've just tried to simplify the whole thing, but if we've lost the crux of this, then certainly we'll just put it back in. Thank you, Chair. I'll continue on slide 15. A new clause 5.2 was inserted to oblige the post office to comply with policy made by the minister and to provide that any decision taken by the board which is in conflict with the policy made by the minister is of no force and effect. Then we've also added, we'll get to it later, but a corresponding policy making power for the minister later in the bill. 5.2a then reads the post office must comply with policy made by the minister in terms of section 29.2. Any decision taken by the board which is in conflict with the policy contemplated in paragraph A is of no force and effect. Clause 6 deals with the powers of the post office. Clause 6.2b was amended to provide that certain specific sections apply with the necessary changes to subsidiaries of the post office. I think we were mandated to go back and to check, is this wording appropriate, and can the whole Act apply to subsidiaries? Would that be the right way to go? We then investigated all the relevant sections of the bill and tried to determine which sections, in our view, should also apply to subsidiaries. So in our view, it should now read sections 11, 14, 23, 24, 25, 27, 28, and 30 apply with the changes required by the context to any subsidiary of the post office, while the post office is the sole member and shareholder of that subsidiary. Clause 11 deals with disqualification from membership of board and disclosure. Clause 14, disclosure and fiduciary duties of board members. 23, application of PFMA, 24, investigation of post office, 25, limitation of liability, 27, application of Companies Act to post office, 28, certain provisions of Companies Act may be declared inapplicable, and 30, offences and penalties. So we would propose that those clauses then also apply with the necessary changes to subsidiaries. Clause 8 is the clause that deals with government support to the post office and loans by the post office. We've reworded clause 8.1 to remove some ambiguity, because as the Honourable Member De Lange pointed out, there may be more than one interpretation the way the existing clause read. So we'll propose that clause 8.1 now reads, Parliament may fund the normal expenditure of post office out of money appropriated for the purpose. And a consequential amendment in clause 8.3 that just says the payment of financial support is subject to the appropriation made by Parliament and must be for such purposes and periods and subject to such conditions as the Minister may determine with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance. Clause 9, Board of the Post Office. Clause 9 was aligned with the requirement in the Post Bank Bill that two members of the Board of the Post Office must be nominated to serve on the Board of the Post Bank. This obligation to nominate upon invitation by the Minister was included in Clause 9.5. The amendments also seek to ensure that the two board members so nominated obtain their mandate from the Board of the Post Office and are accountable to the Board of the Post Office. Clause 9.5 reads, the Board must, upon invitation by the Minister, nominate non-executive members of the Board for appointment to the Board of the South African Post Bank Limited, as contemplated in Section 14.1b of the Post Bank Act. 9.6a, the non-executive members of the Board appointed to the Board of the South African Post Bank Limited must, before attending any meeting of the Board of that company, obtain a proper mandate from the Board of the Post Office. 9.6b, the members referred to in paragraph A are accountable to the Board of the Post Office in respect of their functions performed as board members of the South African Post Bank Limited.
Can you explain subclause 6 for me, please, 6a? What does that mean?
This clause enables the board members that are actually post office board members but have been nominated to serve on the post bank, that they get their mandate from the post office. So before attending a meeting, for example, they have to get their mandate from the post office.
Does it mean that the board of the post office must meet before every meeting of the board of the post bank?
It would imply that, Chairperson.
And if they can't meet, then?
It would obstruct the post bank in proceeding.
Isn't this an onerous provision? I understand the principle of mandating, but I mean, in real life, it means for them. They must first have an idea of what is the agenda items for any post-bank meeting. And before the post bank actually discusses that, the board of the post office must meet to say, yes, we agree you should take the following position. Now, when they go there and exercise the mandate and they're outvoted, if the majority says otherwise, then what must they do? Come back and say what? If the mandate was not carried. Then what happens? Can we come back to this one and let the lawyers look at it?
We'll think about it, Chair, and propose alternatives in this regard. Clause 11 is the clause about the disqualification from membership of the board and disclosure. Firstly, the title was amended, and we then really amended the whole clause to make it similar to the already well-discussed provisions in the Post Bank Bill. The amendments ensure in clause 11.1G that a board member may not have an interest in conflict with the business of the post office and must be a South African citizen. The new clause provides that a person nominated for appointment as a member of the board must, before appointment and upon request by the minister, submit to the minister full disclosure of financial interests and a declaration that he or she has no direct or indirect interest in conflict with the business of the company. The amendment also make provision for further financial interests and conflicts arising after appointment and how that should be treated. Clause 11.4 is a transitional provision that requires that existing members of the board of the post office must, as soon as possible after the commencement of this act, but not later than 3 months thereafter, submit to the minister and the board a written statement containing their financial disclosure and interest declaration. This is the transitional provision. Clause 11 further states that if an existing member of the board of the post office has any direct or indirect interest in conflict with the business of the company, when this act comes into operation, the member must within 3 months after the commencement divest himself or herself of that interest. The proposed wording of clause 11 is therefore as follows. 11.1, a person may not be appointed as a board member or remain a member of the board if he or she, A, is a member of parliament, any provincial legislature or any municipal council, B, is an unrehabilitated insolvent, C, has been declared by a court to be mentally ill or disordered, D, has at any time been convicted, whether in the Republic or elsewhere, of theft, fraud, forgery, or uttering a forged document, perjury, an offence in terms of the Prevention of Combating of Corrupt Activities Act, or any other offence involving dishonesty, or an offence under this Act. E, has been sentenced after the commencement of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, 1993, to a period of imprisonment of not less than 1 year without the option of a fine, has at any time been removed from an office of trust on account of misconduct. G, has any direct or indirect interest in conflict with the business of the post office, or H, is not a South African citizen. Subclause 11.2, a person who is subject to a disqualification contemplated in subsection 1A, 1B or 1G may be nominated for appointment as a board member, but may only be appointed if at the time of such appointment he or she is no longer subject to that disqualification. 3A, a person nominated for appointment as a member of the board must, before appointment and upon a request from the minister, submit to the minister a written statement containing Roman 1, a full disclosure of all his or her financial interests, and Roman 2, a declaration that he or she has no direct or indirect interests that are in conflict with the business of the post office as contemplated in subsection 1G. Subclause B, if after appointment, a member of the board acquires any further financial interest contemplated in A1, the member must immediately in writing declare that fact to the minister and the board. Or two, direct or indirect interest contemplated in subsection 1G, the member must immediately declare the fact to the minister and the board. 4A, any member of the board of the post office referred to in section 3.2C, so this is the... This refers to the existing board members of the post office, the current board members, must, as soon as possible after the commencement of this act, but not later than 3 months thereafter, submit to the minister and the board a written statement containing the disclosure and declaration referred to in subsection 3A. B, notwithstanding subsection 1G, if a member of the board of the post office referred to in paragraph A has any direct or indirect interest in conflict with the business of the post office, when this act commences, the member must... Roman 1, immediately declare that fact to the minister and the board, and within 3 months after the commencement of this act, divest himself or herself of that interest. Lastly, C, subsection 3B also applies to a board member referred to in 3.2C. In other words, Chair, if an existing board member acquires a further financial interest or becomes conflicted after the commencement of this act, that member must declare it to the minister and the board. Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable members, I hand over to Willie.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to get clarity from Mr. Wolf. So I think when we last discussed this whole issue, I think Mr. De Lange also put a lot of emphasis on the fact that, you know, stupid words, a person must be clean, you know. And afterwards, for instance, he or she is a board member, and then get hold of interest, so he can still carry on then, or must he or she resign after disclosure? Because we sort of said to each other, you know, it's one thing to disclose and then just carry on regardless. I'm not sure if I understand it correctly now, Mr. Wolf.
I think it makes provision for disclosure at all times to make sure that nobody is conflicted. So if you're conflicted upon appointment, you need to remove those conflicts. If you're recommended and you have conflicts, you have to remove the conflict before appointment. And if you're appointment and you become conflicted thereafter, you need to disclose it. And then you become disqualified in terms of the disqualification clause, and you have to get out of there as well.
Or you can divest within 3 months and remain.
Yes, the divestiture is for an existing board member.
Because
currently, because of the memorandum and articles of association that currently do allow certain interests, in fact, in the postal industry of board members, it creates a problem. And we last time said, well, we'll have to deal with it in one or another way, either in some form of transitional provision. Either you're going to say only new board members can't be conflicted, but the existing ones can carry on as is, or you'll have to find some form of transition like we've proposed here, that within 3 months after the commencement of this act, they have to then get rid of those interests. In fact, somewhere we even go one step further and we say that if the member cannot, let's say it's a family member that has the interest, then, and the member is not in a position to divest of that specific contract, for example, because it's not under his control, it's his dad's contract with the post office, for example, then the post office can intervene within a legally permissible procedure terminate the interest.
Julie?
Chair, we had a very firm understanding when we discussed the post-bank bill and when we finalized that. And that was very clear. A person who did not declare his or her interest was actually making him and herself or herself guilty of an offense. And we actually introduced very sharp, razor-sharp sort of instruments of penalties. Now, we have last time decided as a principle that we will adopt the same punitive measures in this bill. No sort of, can I say, pussyfooting, you know, you have some and you must digest and, you know, it's your parent or whatever. We have said very clearly what the position is. You cannot take up a position, and as soon as you enter into any sort of arrangement where you have a conflict of interest, you must remove yourself. And I cannot recall that we have a 3-month period to actually phase yourself out, because we have, in fact, we've said we want to have introduced in this bill the same measures as we had and passed in the other bill. Thank you.
Chair, if I can please clarify, remember that in the post-bank bill, we're just dealing with a new company. There's only a new board to be appointed. So it's easy to state in there no interest whatsoever before being appointed. But in this bill, we're dealing with an existing company, the post office, and we're dealing with an existing board. And that existing board have rights under the memos and articles of the company. That existing board potentially have conflicts. They potentially have companies in the postal sector. So we have to deal with those vested rights in one or another way. And that's why in this instance you require a transitional provision for the existing board members. The bill still has the other provisions that says whoever is appointed as board member going forward may not have any interest. So that's exactly the same as the Postbank bill. However, we had to cater here for the existing board members as well. So when this act commences, you'll already have a board and they'll have interest. And this then says, firstly, you have to declare that immediately to the board and the minister. Secondly, you have to get rid of those interests within 3 months.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. I just want to add to what Mr. Woods have said. What you will not want to have, if you don't have such transitional arrangements, is to have a thing whereby the board is dysfunctional to a point where it can't do its business. So you need to provide for the provisions in such a way that the company continues to do its work and the board continues to do its work, you know, so that way. So hence, transitional arrangements that need to be there are quite very much critical and important. I just want to add that to the question.
Is that clear?
Chief, if I may, I just want a bit of clarity on what was said about the post office having a responsibility to also check out what is going on and then remove anyone that they deem fit. Won't you just explain that again? Because I find it's a bit difficult for me to get my head around the fact that the post office would actually do an investigation at any time and then remove someone. Because what kind of manpower would they be using? Who would do it?
No, let me help you here.
Yeah, please.
What's happening is that we have a current board of the post office. Now, a new law is making provisions for new requirements for entry. So if any new member is going to be appointed, he or she must comply with these provisions. But for existing board members whose terms of office have not ended, we are now putting new conditions. So we're giving them a 3-month period. Either they divest in 3 months and remain members of the board, or the only other option after that, if they refuse to divest the financial interest, they must resign. But we're giving them a 3-month period to do that, because you can't immediately disengage from your financial interest. That's what we're trying to do here. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Perhaps we were getting ahead of ourselves, because we'll deal with that in Clause 14, but let me just go straight to that, because Clause 14.3 says if a member of the board of the post office referred to in 3.2c, so that's the existing board, has any direct or indirect interest, when this act commences, the member must immediately declare the fact to the minister and the board, and within 3 months after the commencement, divest himself or herself of that interest. So that's easy. The member himself, he's got this interest. But remember, the member cannot have the interest, and that type of interest includes interest by a family member. So your son has a contract with the post office. That's prohibited in here, right? So in that scenario, how do I as the member divest myself of that interest? Because the legal relationship is between my son and the post office. So therefore, we've proposed a clause that reads in sub 4, 14 sub 4, the post office must ensure the lawful termination of any interest contemplated in subsection 3 within 3 months after the commencement of this act, or as soon as it is legally permissible. So now the post office must step in and say, right, we can't have a board member whose son has a contract with us. So if it has a notice clause, we need to give them notice and get out of the contract. Otherwise, if it's a fixed contract for 12 months, the legally permissible way is we'll have to go through the 12 months and by that time terminate the contract.
Okay. Just one thing, E, Reverend, where you end up?
It was just a minor question, Chairperson. Practically, what then happens after such a declaration of interest has been made, say, if a board meeting is proceeding, what is the position of that conflicted member? Does he or she recuse himself or herself? What is the practical point before the divestiture?
In the 3 month period.
Within that 3 month period.
One would have to look at all the implications, but in principle, if you then declare that you're conflicted, Clause 14.1a says you may not be present or take part in the discussion or the taking of any decision on any matter before the board in which you as a member, your business partner, associate, has a direct or indirect interest. So you must immediately refrain from participating in board meetings. Of course, it has other implications as well, going to removal and the removal clause and resigning.
Chairperson, the reason why I was asking that question was because we were told this was to avoid the dysfunctionality of the board. Such a provision would immediately lead to, let's say there are two or three or four, to a dysfunctionality of the board. Can there be a provision to avoid that as well during the interim?
Can we look at that? Because it's the same effect of a resignation.
I agree with the department. It's not, let's not look for problems where there are none. They envisage a situation where, let's say there are four agenda items, and not all those board members would be conflicted on all those agenda items. They would have different interests. So one member would perhaps at a time recuse himself if an issue is dealt with that affects that particular board member. So I don't think there's any other way to get around this issue. I think it's sufficiently tight, in my view.
Except that you must always use the word herself, because you're assuming men are always conflicted. Please.
Chairperson, I just want clarity. For instance, in that window period of 3 months, a certain individual is eligible to be on the board and everything. He disclosed everything and so forth and so forth. But some people can cause a lot of damage in 3 months' time. So from the board chairperson or the other board members, will they be cautioned to say no, you can't take part in this discussion because you are involved with this or that? As example, please remove yourself from this meeting. So will there be a sensitivity around this whole issue before the end of that 3 months?
Well, firstly, the requirement in the bill is you have to immediately disclose. So when this act commences, immediately you disclose your interest. So immediately the rest of the board and the chair and then the minister is well informed then of the conflict. And because of the conflict that you have declared, the other clauses kick in, like the one that says you can't participate in board meetings and take decisions in those circumstances.
Just E, is that right? 19th Constitution of 1993 or 1996?
I remember the same question being asked to the State Law Advisor in one of our previous meetings, and Mr. Smuts clarified that it isn't, in fact, the correct reference. But Ntombi is here as well. She may add to that. Thank you.
So we named the Constitution after the old Constitution, the interim Constitution. What kind of law is
this? I think the intention...
Chair, the 1996 one is not an X. If you refer to Constitution, it's 1993. Remember, there's been an amendment made, I think amendment 11 or 12, to remove the brackets X in between. It's not an X. The X is 1993 Constitution.
Oh, yes. Okay, that's fine. E, 9, on the top of page 9. Just the title of it's the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, 1993, Act number 200, I'm asking, shouldn't it be 1996?
Chair, the intention is to refer to the interim Constitution and not to the Constitution.
Why? Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct in the context. Yeah, I think that is correct in the context because we're looking specifically at the period when our new dispensation commenced.
Has been sentenced after the commencement. Okay, yeah. All right.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. We'll move to slide number 34, clause 12, appointment of non-executive members of the board. Clause 12.1 was amended to ensure that the requirement that some members of the board must be fit and proper, as captured in the Post Bank in the Banks Act, in taking into consideration when the minister invites nominations for appointment of board members. I think this submission was made in the previous meeting by this committee, that taking into account that other members of the Post Office Board may sit as board members of the Post Bank. Because of requirement of fit and proper, we need to ensure that they go through the necessary requirements by the Register of Bank. The requirement that trade unions are invited to make recommendation was deleted as required by the PCC. Skills, knowledge, or experience in the banking business were included in the Clause 12.4, taking into account the equation of banking requirements. Clause 12.4c, the nomination committee must also consider the requirement that some members of the board must be fit and proper persons to hold the office of a member of the board of banking institution as contemplated in the Banks Act, as my translations initially. Whether a candidate has any direct or indirect interest in the conflict with this business or post office, clause 12.6 was amended to require that at least 1.5 times the required number of board members are recommended, as agreed in this committee when dealing with the post bank matters. Clause 12.7 was amended to remove the requirement that 2 non-existent members of the board must be appointed from suitable persons nominated by the trade unions as required by the committee. Clause 12.8 was improved to make it clear how long a member that fills a vacancy must serve on the board. Further than that, 12.1, for the purpose of appointing non-executive members of the board, the minister must, by notice in two newspapers in the Gazette, invite interested persons. And the B was amended in that regard to ensure that we submit within the period that period and in the manner mentioned in the notice, the names of the persons fit to be appointed as members of the board with due regards to section 9.5 above. Clause 12 further ensured that the minister must appoint a nomination committee to make recommendations to the minister for the appointment of the non-executive members of the board. Clause 12 further and 12.3, in having a nomination committee, the minister must A, ensure that the committee broadly reflects the race and gender composition of the Republic, and B, ensure that the committee members have the necessary skills, knowledge, qualifications, and experience to serve on the committee. Clause 12.4, the nomination committee, in making the recommendation to the minister, must consider A, the proven skills, knowledge, qualification, and experience of candidates in areas of 1, financial management, 2, project management, 3, governance compliance, 4, risk management, 5, transformation, and diversity equity. 6, inclusive banking business as a requirement to ensure that fit and proper persons who may sit in the post bank board. Postal service and post service management or any other field of expertise relevant to the post office. B, the need for representation of 37 persons, the requirement that some members of the board must be fit and proper person to hold the office of a member of the board of a banking institution as contemplated in the Banks Act for purposes of Section 95A. D, whether a candidate has any direct or indirect interest in the conflict with business of the post office as contemplated in Section 11.1G. 5, the committee must ensure that the persons nominated represent a sufficient spread of skills, which is knowledge, qualifications, experience, and able the post office to function efficiently and effectively. Sub 6A, nominations of suitable persons as contained in section 4, section 4, must include at least 1.5 times the number of board members to be appointed. 6B, if a suitable person or the required number of suitable persons are not nominated, the minister may call for further nominations in the manner set out in subsection 1 above. Seven was deleted. And two, the other non-existent members, same with seven, this slide was deleted, taking into account the amendment made initially. the wedding of seven is that the minister must appoint the non-executive members of the board from suitable persons nominated as commissioned in section subsection 4. B, the minister must, within 30 days after appointing the members by notice in the Gazette, publish the names of the persons so appointed and the date of commencement of their terms of office. Clause 12.8, any vacancy occurring in the board in terms of section 13 must be filled in the same manner provided for in these sections. 8b, any member appointed under these subsections hold the office for the rest of the period of the predecessor's term of office unless the minister directs that such persons hold office for a longer period, which may not exceed one subsequent term of up to 3 years. That was clause 12, Honorable Chair. Unless there are questions from honorable members, I shall pause. If none, I shall move to clause 13. Resignations, removal from office and vacancies. Clause 13.2 was approved to provide that a member may be removed if that member A, acted in conflict with this act, B, refuses or fails to make an interest declaration, or refuses or fails to make financial disclosure, C, after having been appointed, acquires any direct or indirect interest in conflict with the business of the post office. D, is a member of the existing board of the post office and Roman figure 1 refused or fails to submit to the minister and the board the written financial interest disclosure statement or refuses or fails to submit the minister and the board an interest declaration or refuses to divest himself or herself of the conflict interests. E, neglected to properly perform the functions of his or her office. F, is a member of the board appointed to the board of the Southern Post Office, Post Bank Limited, and the Register of Banks has informed the minister in accordance with the Banks Act that the member is no longer a fit and proper person to hold that appointment. Or G, is absent from 3 consecutive board meetings without prior leave of the chairperson. That was clause 13, Honorable Chairperson. I shall pause for questions. If none, I shall move to clause 14.
Chairperson, on clause 13, subsection E, the neglect to properly perform the functions of office, other than the non-attendance at board meetings, what is contemplated here? Chairperson, I'm trying to think of a situation where a member is accused of having neglected to properly perform his or her functions as a member of the board, other than declaring one of maybe ongoing failure to attend board meetings. Is there a definition elsewhere or some kind of contemplated misconduct or anything?
Well, Chair, for one, it's all the functions that you have to perform as a board member. I mean, certainly there must be a number of issues that you do as a board member trying to steer an organization. For one, you may be nominated to sit on, to chair the audit committee, for example, and in performing that function, you need to do that properly, make sure that the committee convenes, that you read relevant documentation before you apply your mind, that you actually apply your mind in making decisions, etc. One of potentially many examples in this regard, Chair.
But doesn't this leave this open to a wide discretion? Because the minister only needs to call in the member, make certain allegations, hear him or her out, and then still says, I don't like you, I'm removing you. I don't believe you're doing your job. What's the criteria? What's the test? for neglect to perform function. If I come to every board meeting and I don't say a word, just that I don't say yes, no, I vote when I have to vote. Am I neglecting my duties? Technically, I'm useless, you know that. But I'm there, I've attended all the meetings, I haven't done anything wrong.
Well, Chair, without, I think, it being necessary to define negligence, I think it's, State Law Advisor would say, it's determined by case law, it's determined by the circumstances. We'll probably apply, a court will probably apply a reasonable board member test to say how would a reasonable board member have acted in those circumstances. By just keeping quiet may constitute negligence if the reasonable board member would in those circumstances have aired a view, especially if you have information which you deliberately then haven't disclosed when a certain decision was taken. But certainly it's not one of those easy things. But there would be enough, I think, case law to assist in coming up with the exact meaning of that.
Lawyer? We can keep that. Is it sufficiently defined in law? That's fine, as long as the legal people help us. Can I just ask, why did we drop D in 13D, the old D? The person acted in conflict with the Articles of Association of the Post Office. The old 13D, because you're reading the amendment, but if you see that, have you still got that there?
It might be omitted, Chair. We've just looked at sub 2 and we saw short and it's not what's intended, and we copied the wording from the post bank bill just as is.
But it is an important matter.
We haven't intentionally omitted it. Acted in conflict with the articles.
If you look at the deleted section, D. Now, if a person acts in conflict with the Articles of Association, shouldn't that be a ground for removal?
Well, Chair, if I can try. I think because your memos and articles are issued in terms of this Act, it goes without saying because 2A says acted in conflict with this Act, so that includes the memos and articles. So I think it's covered and we do not have to have a specific reference to the old 2D.
Julie?
Jefferson, I however, feel we should. And the reason being that in many of our state-owned entities, we have a serious governance issue. And whatever sort of belts and braces we could put into legislation and have clarity about issues, I think we should include it. Because one of the critical documents in the post office and in the SABC, etc., is also the Articles of Association. And sometimes I fear that in the public sector, we still need to make sure that people are understanding the complexity of such bodies, but also the responsibilities that they carry when they assume office.
Can we consider including that?
I think the submission has been considered.
Okay, thank you. 14.
Clause 14, disclosure and fiduciary duties of the board members. Members should recall that in the previous meeting, the advice was offered that we should be able to align the two bills as it is. The whole of Clause 14 was repealed to correspond with the similar clause in the Post Bank Bill. A provision was added in Clause 14.3 to provide that if an existing board member has any direct or indirect interest when this Act commences, the member must, Roman figure 1, immediately declare that fact to the minister and the board, and 2, within 3 months after commencement of this act, divest himself or self that interest. I think members have discussed this matter initially. Clause 14.4 was also added to oblige the post office to ensure the lawful termination of any interest conflict in clause 14.3 within 3 months after the commencement of this act or as soon as legally permissible. The same provision has been discussed by members. This provision caters for the situation where a family member has a contract with the post office resulting in a conflict of the member, but the member is not in position to terminate it or divest from it. The post office should then intervene. In that regard, members have satisfied themselves in that discussion. Clause 14.1, in addition to any other applicable legislation, the following shall apply to members of the board. A member of the board may not be present or take part in the discussion or taking of decision of any matter before the board in which that member or his or family member, business partner, or associate has a direct or indirect interest, as indicated earlier on. B, a member of a board or his of a family member, business partner, or associate of organization or enterprise in which a member of the board or his or a family member, business partner, associate has a direct or indirect interest may not, 1, offer goods or services to the post office or conclude any business with the post office, or 2, make improper use in any manner whatsoever of the position of the board member or of any information acquired by a board member by virtue of his or her position as a board member. C, a member of the board must perform his or her functions at all times with the utmost good faith, honesty, and integrity, care, diligence, and furtherance of his or her functions without limiting their scope. Must, 1, take reasonable steps to inform himself or herself about the post office, its business and activities, and the circumstances in which it operates. 2, take reasonable steps through the processes of the board to obtain sufficient information and advice about all matters to be decided by the board, enabling him or her to make conscious informed decisions. 3, regularly attend board meetings. 4, exercise an active and independent discretion with respect of all matters to be decided by the board. 5, exercise due diligence in the performance of his or functions as a member. 6, comply with any internal code of conduct that the post office may establish for board members. 7, not engage in any activity that may undermine the integrity of the post office. Not make improper use of his or position as a member for information acquired by virtue of his or position as a member. 3, any confidential matters related to the post office obtained in his or capacity as board member as strictly confidential and not divulge them to anyone without the authority of the post office or as acquired as part of that person's official function as a member of the board. Clause 14.2, members, a member of the board must make full and immediate disclosure to the board of any direct or indirect interests contemplated in subsection 1. 3, if a member of the board of the post office referred to section 3.2c has any direct or indirect interests contemplated subsection 1, when this act commences, the member must, 1, immediately declare that fact to the minister and the board, and 2, within 3 months after the commencement of this act, divest itself or itself for that interest. 14.4, the post office must ensure the lawful termination of any interest contemplated in subsection 3 within 3 months after the commencement of this act or as soon as it's legally permissible. Honourable Chair, if there are no questions, Clause 14, I shall move to section.
Just a question. Isn't there a repetition now between 11 and 14? 11 says disqualification for membership of board and disclosure. And then we've got that clause that you got there at the bottom of the, at the end of that, right? Then 14 says disclosure and fiduciary duties of the board members. And then you're basically repeating that last three, one and two again. Is it necessary? Because we've got now two sections on disclosure.
Chair, let me just look at the exact ones, but the conflict issue will come up when you appoint. It'll then have to appear again in the disqualification clause. It'll later appear in the offences clause. So it seemingly you start reading it over and over, but hopefully it's in the right context. It's supposed to be there. But if you can just refer us to those exact two clauses, we'll just investigate.
It's on page 14. Three is the repetition.
Is it clause 14, Chair?
Yeah, clause 14. On page 14 also, on the top there. Two and three, I think, are repetitions. Am I right? Because you've got exactly the same clauses in the disqualification on the 11. You'll have a look at it.
We'll have a look at it. One relates to disclosure or the fiduciary duty as such, and it's linked to a certain offence, and the other one is linked to... But you can probably cross-reference in one way or another.
Okay. Fine. 15. We can move on.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. Clause 15, procedures at meetings and committees of board. A new clause 15.1 was inserted to provide for procedure at meeting of the board, the quorum, and the validity of the decision taken by the board. 15.1, the wording 1A, the board determines its procedures at meetings. 70% of the 7 members constitute a quorum at any meeting of the board. A decision taken by the board or at performed under that decision is not valid merely by reason of 1. Any regularity in the appointment of the member, 2. A vacancy in the board, or the fact that any person not entitled to sit as a member sat as such at the time when the decision was taken, provided such decision was taken by a majority of the members present at the time and entitled so to sit, and those members at the time constitute a quorum. If no questions, Chair shall move to clause 22. Clause 22, personnel of post office. Clause 22.1 was improved to require that the board must determine the structure or organogram of the post office and the condition of service, remuneration, and service benefits of the personnel of the post office after consult with the chief executive officer and with the concurrence of the minister and minister of finance. 22.1, the board must determine the structure or organogram of the post office and the condition of service, remuneration, and the service benefits of personnel of the post office as concerns the Minister of the Executive Minister of Finance. That's the wording of 22.1, which is a new provision in the bill assistance. 22.2 was amended to provide that the work relating to the function of the post office is performed by such persons as the Chief Executive Officer may, with the concurrence of the board, appoint. The wording of 22.2 reads thus in the revised bill: the work relating to the function of the post office is performed by such persons as the CEO may, with the concurrence of the board, appoint. I shall pause, Honorable Chair, if there are questions in clause 22. If none, I shall move to clause 25, intervention by the minister. Clause 25 was approved, Honorable Chair. Clause 25.1b was amended to enable the minister to direct the post office to take action when the post office has failed to comply with policy made by the minister. A new clause 22.5 was inserted to require that the minister must A. review the performance of the post office regularly whilst it is under administration, and B. within 6 months of appointment as administrator, table the report on his findings in the National Assembly. Clause 25.7 was amended to provide when the appointment of the administrator terminates. A new clause 25.8 was added to ensure that the rights of the minister to seek leave in court are not affected. The wording of clause 25 as amended and improved: the minister may direct the post office to take any action specified by the minister if the post office has fail to comply with any law or any policy envisaged in this act. 25.5, the minister must A. review the performance of the post office regularly whilst it's under administration, and B. within 6 months of appointing the administrator, table a report on his or findings in the National Assembly. 25.7a, the cost associated with the appointment of an administrator shall be of the account of the post office. B, the appointment of the administrator terminates when the board member has been replaced in terms of subsection 6C, Roman figure 2. 25(8), notwithstanding with this section, the minister retains the right at any time to approach a competent court for relief in any matter he or she considers appropriate in furtherance of this act. That was clause 25, honorable members, intervention by the minister. As it is improved, I shall pause for questions, clarity, and comment. Thanks, Honorable Chair. I shall move clause 27, application of Companies Act to Post Office. In clause 27.2a, the ways incapable of being applied were substituted by the ways inapplicable, as agreed by this committee while discussing the Post Bank Bill. Clause 29, regulations and policy. A policy-making power is inserted in clause 29, including the requirement that such policy must be approved by a cabinet table, National Assembly, and gazetted. 29.1, the minister may make regulations regarding, one, any matter relating to the function of the board that is necessary to ensure efficiency and effectiveness in the performance of its functions, and b, any ancillary of central administration or procedural matter that is necessary to prescribe for the proper implementation of this act. Two, the minister may make policies on matters of national policy applicable to the post office consistent with the object of this act, and may at any time thereafter amend any such policies made. Three, when making or amending a policy under Section 2, the minister must, one, obtain cabinet approval, b, table the policy in the National Assembly at least 3 days before publishing the final version of the policy in terms of paragraph C above, c, publish the final version of the policy in the Gazette. That was clause 29, Honorable Chairperson, on policy making. Thank you. I shall move to clause 30, offenses and penalties. Clause 30 was amended to criminalize non-disclosure of financial interest and non-submission of the interest declaration by new and existing board members, as well as non-compliance with certain fiscal duties. It further criminalizes the contravention of the prohibition of doing business with the post office by members, their family members, business partners. The wording of clause 34, which is a new insertion, says any member of the board who fails to comply with the section 13.11(3)(b), Roman figure 1 or 2, or 11(4)(b)(a), Roman figure 1, or 14(2), or who contravenes section 14(1)(c), Roman figure 7, 8, or any former member fails to comply with or contravene any of those sections while being a member, commits an offense and is liable of conviction to a fine or to imprisonment not exceeding 5 years, or to both a fine and such imprisonment. Clause 35, any person referred to in section 14(1)(b) who contravened that section, or any former member of the board who contravened that section while being a member, or any person other than a member of the board referred to section 14(1)(b) who contravened that section during the tenure of a former member, commits an offense and is liable on conviction to a fine or to imprisonment not exceeding 5 years, or both a fine and such imprisonment. I shall pause for questions, clarity, comments on clause 30.
Okay. Can I just ask the board, the composition of the board? Did we agree on 13 members? I'm just trying to remember. Yes, because we said 3 is the executive position,
yeah.
And then the board, and then it's 9 others, am I right?
I think, Honorable Chair, your observation is quite right in that regard, but however, if you remember in the last meeting, this committee mandated the post office to go and motivate. Remember, this provision came from the post office. To go and motivate, they talk about the number of committees they had, number of subsidiaries, and we thought post office will come present in this regard. So this matter, chairperson, you are quite right. It was given to post office to provide the number of boards in terms of their operations. We agree with you, but there was no determination made in that meeting.
Nikki? Yeah, but isn't that where Johnny came in and said we want this proper briefing? Because we got the impression then that a member of the post office board was sitting on two or three other subsidiary boards doing multiple work and function and that kind of thing. And until we get that report, we said we were not going to make a decision. But the general view of the committee is that a board of 13 non-executive is too large. We want to start streamlining these things. So let's come back to this. I think in the next, whenever the committee next meets, we should get the post office to come and do that presentation to us. Because it's conditional on that.
Yeah.
Also, Chair, there seems to be almost precedents that have been created. Remember the whole issue of interference into the day-to-day management of bodies. And what is the role of the board? And why is it that you need to have the board sort of represented in every little subcommittee, etc.? I mean, we must also deal with those matters, because that is ultimately not creating the type of structures for good governance that we are supposed to set up. So I really want to say that the post office will have to convince us of what how do they see the role? I mean, you know, most effective boards of organizations meet once per month with recommendations that have been made, and not everything needs to go to the board. I mean, there are delegated authority frameworks and all of that the organization can function. Board meets once or twice, at most once a month, and then, you know, because the rest, the professionals must run. It's a professional organization. It must be people appointed. Otherwise, they duplicate the work. They have long, protracted meetings, and they quarrel with each other, and they interfere in each other's activities and functions, etc. We must really try to get this right. Thank you, Chair.
Just on that, can I come back to page 17, 22B? I think that's a similar point that Judy's making. We've got there the work related to the functions of the post office. I suppose that's the operational function. It's performed by such persons as the chief executive officer may, with the concurrence of the board, appoint. Do we need concurrence? I mean, because it's almost as if the chief executive, I mean, if he or she appoints even middle management people or junior people to carry out certain functions, he must or she must get the concurrence of the board. that's an operational matter, isn't it? Is that the point you're making also, isn't it?
Chair, we're guilty in the sense that we've merely copied from the post-bank bill without further applying our mind to it, believing that this committee, through its deliberation and adoption of the previous bill, have well considered the issue. But if we can further improve it, certainly, Chair.
It's good that we are a little bit awake, you know.
We must remember the post-bank bill had, I mean, that was a bank, and there were heightened criteria.
Nikki? Yeah.
Just quickly on the point of interfering in the day-to-day operations of the entity, you remember, Chairperson, the problems we had with Centec last year, and it may be possible that this can occur also in the post office of board members. We know they're keen and they want to do a good job and everything. But then the interference starts.
Tiki?
I don't know whether I will be relevant. But if my memory serves me well, we discussed this point. Because there was a concern. I remember we're sitting at a good center. In terms of the powers of that board, in terms of employing the management, as well, who's the responsibility? Is it the board? The board is responsible to employ the CEO. Then the CEO will be responsible to employ the management. That was the discussion, if my memory serves me, and we agreed. Let the CEO, the board will do its own, and then the CEO then will come in and employ the management.
Okay, can we look at it again?
We can certainly chair, especially because the role of the board is already embedded in 2022-1. Yeah. There the board must already approve the whole organogram, the structure with the conditions of service. So already you have your fixed staff complement. It's now for the CEO to just go implement that. He probably don't have to run back to the board each time. It may cause hindrance, so we'll agree to that, Chair.
Right, last one, the 32, this act is called the South African Post Office Limited Act, and then you delete it and takes effect on the date determined by the chairperson of this committee.
By notice in the Gazette.
So shouldn't we complete that, because I see you're deleting that. Is that correct? 32. When does it take effect? Normally we say on a date determined by the president or the minister. Now you deleted that. Is this normal?
Yeah, the Constitution says upon publication it commences if nothing else is said. So there are alternatives such as having the minister determine it or the president determine it, as in the case of the post-bank bill. Now, why you would do that is because if you need to do certain preparatory work, the act would become an act, but you need to, for example, in the case of the post bank, you know, you need to go develop those policies. And then once it's developed, then you put the act into operation because you only have a short period of time to promulgate those policies. But in this case, it's an existing organization running. There's no real preparation, additional preparation required. So we think it's...
So once the president assents, then it's into operation.
The moment it's gazetted, it becomes law and commences.
Okay, now I see there are lots of amendments and repeals and all that. Now, you know, we're not going to go through that now. Can we get the lawyers to really look at this thing? Because this is the most difficult section. And we don't know what the other acts are saying. So can the legal people do the homework for us here? And just check that everything is in order. Can we give that to which team? The whole team, including the parliamentary legal team, to reassure us that everything is correct there.
I must be ready tomorrow morning.
Yeah. Right, I think we're done. Members, next week, I think we're meeting again on Tuesday. If the post office people could be invited to give us whatever briefing, and then we start going into just a careful scrutiny of every section so that we are clear that that's what we're happy with. If we don't adopt next week, then we take it to our caucuses? Yes, take it to our caucuses, and then the following week we approve. We go forward the final stages. Niki?
Chairperson, I just want to mention it. The DA's got his first caucus now, the 28th of October. Then will be our first caucus. You also, the NC. Okay, but I thought maybe we don't have enough time.
Keep that in mind.
Okay, thank you.
And please, tell your caucus mustn't come at the last minute and say they're not there voting against this. Please, rather tell us beforehand that, look, we're voting against this. And we fight it out here. We take off the gloves.
You know, it's the correct thing to do to keep you guessing.
Okay, then we might have to revisit our date. At the moment, I see that Alma is just saying formal deliberations on the 26th of October. We might have to change. If your caucus is only on the 28th. The only concern is that we want this bill to go to the other house so that it can be approved. If we miss that cycle, then this will only go to them next year. If it's possible, we'll appreciate that. Because it's not a contentious bill. I mean, the post office is there. It's 100 years old. At the moment, it's set for the 26th of October, 2 weeks from now. You see, if we don't give it to them in time, then they won't finish it in this house. Yeah. Okay? So we will stick to the date of 2060 if it's possible. Thank you. And I'm also told that the South African, but the post bank bill was approved in the other house yesterday with no amendment. So it doesn't come back to us. It can now go to the president for signing. Otherwise, if they had made amendments, it must come back to us. So we're making some good progress. Members, I said 4 o'clock. It's 1 minute to 4. Can I keep you for 1 minute at least? Just to meet that time at 4 o'clock. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned.